So this is what used to happen. This is what going for refuge used to mean, and still really means, according to the scriptures. Now, I've spoken of hearing the Dharma as having a tremendous impact, as leading to the going for refuge, but seeing the Buddha can have just the same effect, or seeing the Sangha, the spiritual community. There's the well-known example of the Buddha's cousin and disciple, Ananda. Ananda, according at least to the Surangama Sutra, was not converted, to use that term, by hearing the Dharma. How then was Ananda converted? He was converted simply by seeing the Buddha. He didn't hear the Dharma, he just saw the Buddha. And more specifically, the Surangama Samadhi Sutra says, he was converted by seeing the beauty of the Buddha. He saw the Buddha in the distance. He saw his noble, majestic appearance, his golden complexion, his kindly gaze, the light that seemed to radiate from his form, from his features. And Ananda felt, that he hadn't ever seen anything, anyone, so beautiful as this, so beautiful as the Buddha. And this had a tremendous effect, just the beauty of the Buddha, without even hearing the Dharma, without even hearing this beautiful Buddha say anything at all. And as a result of that effect of seeing the Buddha, seeing the beauty of the Buddha, Ananda was drawn forth from the household life. He became, for many years, the faithful attendant of the Buddha, looking after him, introducing people to him, running errands. And eventually, after the Buddha's parinirvana, Ananda gained enlightenment. So we should not forget this aspect. Beauty may or may not be truth, but truth, we may say, is certainly beauty. And beauty, spiritual beauty, undoubtedly has a tremendous attractive power, a tremendous power of fascination. And this is why in later Buddhist art, later Buddhist iconography, the bodhisattvas, unlike the arahants, the bodhisattvas are depicted as beautiful young princes. And what does this fact represent? It represents the fact that enlightenment, and the bodhisattvas are, after all, enlightened, or their personifications or embodiments of enlightenment, or of this or that aspect of enlightenment, enlightenment is eternally, everlastingly young, because it's always new, always fresh, never grows old. And enlightenment is supremely attractive. So the bodhisattvas are represented as beautiful young princes. And then there's not only seeing the Buddha, seeing the beauty of the Buddha, there's also seeing the Sangha. There's not only a Dharma and a Buddha, or a Buddha and a Dharma, there's a Sangha. Seeing the Sangha too, seeing the spiritual community can have a tremendous effect. This also can lead one to go for refuge. And there are many examples of this too. You may remember some of them. One or two of them I've mentioned already. You may recollect the story of that king, in the Buddha's own day, Ajatasattu. And what had this king done? What had he done to gain the throne? He'd done a very terrible thing. He'd murdered his own father and shut up his own mother in prison. And his mind was very uneasy on this account. And he consulted with his friend Jivaka, the physician. And Jivaka said, you'd better go and see the Buddha. He said, I'll take you to see the Buddha. So they went forth one night, all of them, the whole court, mounted on elephants, 500 elephants, most of them carrying the ladies of the harem. So they went into the forest, the king and Jivaka, the courtiers and all these women. And at the edge of the forest they dismounted. Jivaka was leading the king deeper and deeper and deeper into the forest. And it was a very dark night. And in any case, the branches of the trees were thickly interlaced above their heads. And the king, with his guilty mind, became very suspicious, very afraid. And he said, Jivaka, you're not leading me into a trap, are you? Jivaka said, no, your majesty, no. We haven't very far to go. It's just a little way further on. So they went a little more deeply into the forest. It got darker and darker and quieter and quieter. And the king got very, very suspicious again, and he said, Jivaka, didn't you tell me that the Buddha was staying in this forest with 1,250 monks? He said, I can't hear a sound. Surely there'd be some sound with all those monks. You're not leading me into a trap. Jivaka says, no, no, your majesty. Huh? It's only a little way further on. You'll soon see. And in fact, within a matter of minutes, the king saw. There was a little clearing. A single lamp was burning. And there was a monk sitting in the moonlight, all around the Buddha, 1,250 of them. And the Buddha in the middle, in complete silence, because it was a full moonlight. And just then the moon came out from behind a cloud, and the king saw the whole assembly, 1,250 bhikkhus, all seated around the Buddha in this great clearing, just meditating in the middle of the night, and not a sound, not a cough. No one even blew his nose. Bhikkhus don't have handkerchiefs. So the king was so impressed by this sight. The sight of the Sangha. The sight of the Sangha. Not just the Buddha, the Sangha. And he hadn't heard the Dharma. Not yet. He just saw the Sangha. And he was so impressed. And he had a son called Udaya. And he said to Jivaka, I only wish that my son Udaya may enjoy the same peace of mind that these monks enjoy, that this Sangha enjoys. He knew that to hope for peace of mind for himself was impossible because he'd committed such a terrible crime. But he wished it for his son. So he was so deeply impressed, so deeply moved, even this murderous, suspicious monarch, by the sight of the order, the spiritual community. Well, there's another famous example, this time from China, from the Tang Dynasty. Apparently there was a famous Chinese scholar, or poet of the Tang Dynasty, who wasn't a Buddhist. It seems he was a rather strict Confucian. And one day he went to visit a Chan monastery, that to say a Zen monastery. And the monks there were all so beautifully disciplined. They wore their robes so neatly. They walked about so sedately. They ate in such a refined, mindful fashion. They spoke to each other so politely. They were so aware. They moved about so beautifully that this strict Confucianist, this scholar, this poet, he was deeply impressed. And he exclaimed, I'm not quite sure if I've quoted it correctly, but this is the substance of it. He said in words which have become quite famous in Chinese Buddhist history, he said, ah, the etiquette of the three dynasties is surely embodied here. he was impressed in this way. Etiquette, meaning being a very, very great thing, a very important thing for the Confucianist. So to speak in this way, that the etiquette of the three dynasties was concentrated there in that monastery, there in that Sangha, coming from a Confucianist, that was the highest possible praise. So he was very favourably impressed by Buddhism after that. And there are examples of the same sort of thing, we may say, even nearer home, on a more ordinary level. I've known instances when visitors to Sukhavati have been very impressed by the way in which the order members and mitras there just worked. Talking about work again, I'm afraid. Didn't know anything about the Dharma, hadn't come to hear the Dharma, certainly. And so far there's no Buddha in the shrine. But they saw people working together. And they were impressed. And the same thing happened, perhaps in an even more striking manner, when I remember, I think it was last year, a team of 6 people went up from Sukhavati to Norwich to help build the centre there. And little echoes and little rumours reached me. And I heard that people have been very, very impressed by the way in which these 6 people worked together. They not only worked smoothly, not only worked efficiently, not only worked very quickly, which was astonishing enough for most people, but they worked as a team. They related to one another very, very well, very positively, almost creatively in the course of the work. And this fact very strongly, even strikingly, impressed a number of people who came along just to have a look and see what they were doing. So it's very important to remember this. It's very important to remember that more often than not, ordinary people, which means the general public, the great British public in our case, will not see the Buddha. Not even the image of the Buddha. They won't hear the Dharma. Won't even read a book on Buddhism, perhaps. But they may see the Sangha. In other words, they may see you. They may see how you behave, how you work, how you relate to one another, whether you're positive or negative, inspiring, good to be with, or depressing, a drag. So a great responsibility rests on you. You, the individual order member, are the public's first point of contact with the whole movement, the whole Buddhist tradition. Just you. I remember that when I was staying at the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, I think that this must have been 1965, 66, someone came to see me. Someone who'd never been to the Vihara before and had no previous contact with Buddhism. I didn't think too much of this because people were always coming to see me in that sort of way. But there was another person staying at the Vihara, someone just spending a few weeks there. He was a Buddhist, an English Buddhist, and he'd happened just to open the door for this visitor of mine. And he afterwards became friendly with this particular visitor, who became a regular frequenter of the Vihara. And the visitor, who became the regular frequenter, he told the person who had opened the door one day when they were talking, that, do you know, when you opened the Vihara door, that was the first time I'd ever seen a Buddhist. And the person who opened the door related this to me afterwards, and he said, when this person told him that, he was staggered. He said, I realized my responsibility. That when I opened the door to this new person, this visitor, I was the first Buddhist he'd ever seen. And he said, I couldn't help wondering what sort of impression I made on him. So remember this, you may be the first Buddhist that somebody, even a whole lot of people, have ever seen. And they're going to take a good look at you. It's almost like seeing some strange new creature in the zoo. They're going to take a really good, hard look. What you look like. Whether you're intelligent, or stupid, dull, or bright, absent-minded or on the ball, friendly
or unfriendly,
warm or distant,
or cool
or not very interested, or couldn't care less, or why don't you go away and not waste my time? I've got better things to do. You know, they're going to take all this in. So you've got a tremendous responsibility. Yes.